What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe, plus allergies-ish.
Plus allergies. Poor Sherlyn has been off for a while and now is just... I think you came on full force, Sherlyn. That's what it
yeah,
was.
I
Your
did.
Body had whiplash from rest.
My body
to...
was like, what is going on? I don't know if it's allergies. So anyway, I apologize for the scratchy voice, but yeah.
Okay, don't worry. We'll take it easy. This week, folks, we have finally learned that Apple has officially announced its next iPhone event for September 12th. Well, we don't know specifically iPhone, right? But, you know, it's iPhone. We all figure that. And now, this is actually a really good time to do a little preview and a little roundup of all the rumors you've had so far. And joining us to talk about that is a special guest, Mark Gurman from Bloomberg. You may know his name from all those leaks. He's the person who leaks most of these reports about Apple and every cool thing that they're working on. So we'll be chatting with him in a bit. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcastandgadget.com. It's always good to have your feedback. We have heard, I think, Ben, we got some good feedback from the last episode. People want to hear more gaming talk, more Ben talk. Thanks to Sumit Roy for sending some feedback there. And yeah, hopefully we'll be bringing back our Thursday live streams. We may actually end up doing some live streams ahead of these Apple events, right? Like, those are important enough for us to get back on video. Well, so we shall see. I don't know.
Yeah. We just have to figure out our like resource situation.
So many issues in media right now. And for us, it's just been live streams. And you know what? Among all the problems out there, it seems like not a huge one. All right, folks, it's that time of the year again. We're waiting for Apple's big event. We're all excited to cover it. And joining us to talk about it is Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg, chief correspondent, writer of the Power On newsletter. Mark, how's it going?
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be on here. Been probably reading Engadget for at least 15 years, maybe 18 to 20.
Oh my God.
So it is.
You know. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and I think it's my first time on an Engadget platform or podcast. So I was very excited when you reached out. So glad to be here.
That's funny. Your name's been on our site a lot, though. You know what I mean?
I mean, listen, listeners will probably know Mark's name because he is usually attached to all the iPhone rumors and Apple rumors that we report. And I will tell you, Mark, I've been writing about tech since like 2010 and even before then. Like, you've been in the game. Like, I think you were in high school, right? Breaking scoops and stuff?
High school, yeah. 2010, end of 2009, early 2010 is when I started as well. So, you know, we're both veterans here.
But let's just say I'm probably
I'm just a
little
fresh little baby.
Sherlyn's a baby.
Fresh little baby.
It's hilarious. But yeah, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us. And I think this is going to be a pretty interesting year for the iPhone. So I'm just going to go down what we basically expect based on your reporting. And a lot of this is from your reporting. But this year, we are expecting the iPhone 15 and the iPhone 15 Pro and Pro Max, 15 Plus as well, too, right? This is also the year of USB-C, right? Based on your reporting, it seems like this is Apple's big shift year, right, for USB-C?
USB-C, yep. That's going to be there across all four iPhone models. In addition, it's going to be there for the new AirPods Pro. And then you'll see them bring USB-C to all of their accessories, whether that's Mac accessories or otherwise. It's interesting the way they have the connector strategy going so far is they have these Macs that all have USB-C, but in order to charge and connect the Mac peripherals, those use Lightning, right? And you have the AirPods that have Lightning, and then they're only going to switch one AirPods at the get-go to USB-C. And so it is going to continue to be a little bit confusing, but within months' time, the strategy is going to become even clearer, where basically everything can charge up through USB-C. So I think that's a positive and about time, right?
I feel like it's going to be less of a difficult transition than the old, Apple connector pin to Lightning. I remember when that was happening, I was covering that. I'm sure you've written about it, Mark. I think a lot of us were asking at the time, why didn't Apple just go straight to USB-C back then? It wasn't widely supported, but it did exist, right? It seemed like a weird decision for them.
Yeah, I think they wanted something proprietary, and there's a number of reasons why they want a proprietary connector. One is their Made for iPhone program, which they get royalties from and revenue from accessory makers. Yeah. And it's sort of difficult to do that when you're using an industry standard. And then Lightning also had a few benefits over USB-C, right? It is smaller, right? It could even be considered, at least by Apple, it was considered more durable at the time. I think the truth is USB-C is more durable because it doesn't have the nine pins on top that can get scraped off, right? So there, so you know, there was a debate, right? And then to your point also, USB-C did exist, but it was super nascent. The switch to Lightning was made in 2012. I don't think USB-C, well, to your point correctly that it existed, I don't think a USB-C ecosystem really took off until 2015, 2016. Now, here's something that really hasn't been talked about. There was a push inside Apple to sort of make Lightning a competitor to USB-C all the way back then. If you remember the 12-inch MacBook, that was the first MacBook with the single USB-C port and the first USB-C Mac. In development, that actually had a Lightning port, right? So they really wanted, right? So they wanted to use Lightning across the line and make that a long-term connector strategy. Obviously, that didn't work out, but you know, things could look very different today had that worked out.
I sometimes think back, like, man, the world would look very different if Apple was just like, hey, yeah, USB-C, whatever. Let's just get on this. Because one thing you've written about is that Lightning is, even though it is smaller, It's definitely not as durable. I don't know what it is with my pockets, but every year my iPhone's little Lightning port gets stuffed with debris and then it just stops connecting properly. Like, I have to do some digging and fishing. That never happens with the USB-C devices, and those pins aren't great. But you've also written, Mark, that Lightning is stuck at USB 2 speeds, and we are well beyond that now. So USB-C could at least unlock faster speeds, right? Faster data transfer, potentially faster charging?
At least on the Pro phones, you'll see faster charging, probably up to 35 watt up from the current, which I believe is closer to, 15 or 20. And then the faster data transfer speeds, that, of course, will require a Thunderbolt cable, which those can go between $50 and $150, depending if you're buying it from Amazon or from Best Buy or from Apple, right? And so, yeah, there are certainly benefits there. But to your point about how this transition is going to go, I can talk about myself personally. Personally, I've been wirelessly charging only probably for close to 4 or 5 years now, right? So I have these MagSafe chargers throughout my home, wireless charging in the car, wireless charging at my office. So I don't really know when I plug in. I mean, I probably plug in once every 3 months or so. Let's say my battery is, down to 5% and I need to get out of here and I'm going to be leaving, right, for 5 hours or something. I need to I put the phone on low power mode. I put the phone on airplane mode. I turn off everything that uses battery life. I plug in a Lightning connector to USB-C into my MacBook Pro charger, and I can get up to like 80% in like half an hour to an hour, right? So that's really the only use case for me for plugging in at this point. I don't sync with iTunes. I don't sync to the computer. It's all through wireless, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I can only speak for myself. I think that it's the way I use my phones is probably representative of you all and maybe most of the people listening to this podcast. But in terms of the general population, most people certainly still plug in. And so I think you will still see a large portion of the population be up in arms about this. Now, Apple will mitigate it by including a pretty nice USB-C cable in the box. The downside is that a large percentage, I would venture to guess the majority of iPhone owners might not necessarily have a power brick with a USB-C at the end. If you remember, Apple stopped including chargers in the box with the iPhone 12. The last phone to include it was the iPhone 11 and the iPhone 11 Pro. The iPhone 11 Pro, that included a power brick with a USB-C connector, but the regular iPhone 11 and all iPhones prior to that, those were USB 2 ports. So I still think a portion of the population will need to buy new power bricks.
Kind of related to all this, we've seen the rumors too that Apple may be working on just a completely portless iPhone moving forward, right? Wireless everything. It seems like it would fit with your life, Mark. I will say, like, I still plug in for like my car, which is not that old. It's a 2019 Volvo with decent tech, but I have to plug in for CarPlay. A lot of people still have to plug in for things. But do you think a portless iPhone is on the horizon, Mark?
I do. I think that the portless iPhone is going to come within a few years from now. I certainly don't think it would have come in time for this European Union requirement for Apple and all these other tech device makers to switch to USB-C. But I do still believe a portless iPhone is coming. It is something they have been testing, and it's going to happen. Obviously, the Apple Watch has technically been portless for a number of years. They'll get there. It'll take a little while longer, but they'll get there.
I have a question about something that kind of we brought up when we just started talking about the switch to USB-C, which is you mentioned the Made for iPhone program, Mark. And I think I have been curious about this. Do you think Apple will make its own USB-C cables along with this launch and sell it more expensive and do the thing where, like, if you use some third party USB-C cable, it's going to be like a little slower, or it's going to throw up this warning that's like, oh, you know, you're not using a compatible charger, it's going to be super dead or super slow?
So I think so, up to a degree. I don't think they'll throw a pop-up or anything like that. I do think there'll be benefit to USB-C cables that are authorized through Apple, maybe in terms of speed and other features. But I think all USB-C cables will certainly work. The other side of it is I don't think Apple will sell through its retail channels or through its authorized partner channels any USB-C cables that are not authorized through the Made for iPhone program, right? So they'll still collect revenue. On the other hand, I don't think it's going to be as lucrative as Lightning was, because all Lightning cables needed that authorization. But these third-party USB-C cables will still work. And so from a consumer standpoint, I don't anticipate an issue there. It's a very small portion of the population who's going to care about charging speeds. Most people are charging at their desk or overnight.
Yeah, I will say I'm glad Apple will not do anything to make USB-C more confusing than it already is, because, oh my God, I love having a single port, but it is so annoying to figure out, like, okay, is this charging at the right speed? Is this Thunderbolt or not? Like, oh man, it is such a mess right now. We should talk about what these new phones will look like, though. And you've done some reporting on that, Mark. It sounds like the iPhone 15 will look a lot like the iPhone 14, but we will likely see the dynamic island on it, right?
So the iPhone 14 didn't really have much new, but the iPhone 15, in terms of the base models, you're going to see improvements there. Basically, they're bringing over a few of the main features. I would say the three main features of the iPhone 14 Pro to the iPhone 15 and iPhone 15 Plus. And so those three features would be the A16 chip from last year's 14 Pro. That would be the dynamic island, but also the camera improvements on the back of the 14 Pro would come to the back of the 15 and 15 Plus. So a few nice upgrades for people who want those lower-end phones. Obviously, those are priced far more aggressively and probably a great deal for most people.
And still no always-on display probably, though, right?
In terms of the always-on display on the regular 14 or coming to the regular 15 and 15 Plus, I had not heard anything about that.
The thing I'm more interested is, when is Apple going to get the promotion stuff? And I guess promotion is in the Pro name, so maybe never. But I would love to see higher refresh rates on the base iPhone, because every Android phone is doing it now.
Once you use promotion, it's sort of hard not to. Like, I'll play with an iPad mini or an iPad Air, like a an iPad without promotion, and it's just so totally different. And before promotion, it looked totally fine, but these days it doesn't look great. And I know this is such a minor thing in the context of life and in the world, but you know, you can tell the difference.
It depends on what you're doing.
Right.
I'm constantly, the way I use my phone, I'm constantly scrolling through people who looked at my Instagram stories, and you can tell a huge difference when the names are jumping and they're not making any sense. It's like, and it's nauseating for me.
You feel it. You feel it in your eyes. We've talked about this before, but like, when you see high refresh rates, folks, it is so smooth. It is like butter, and going back to anything 60 hertz just feels so jittery. So I don't know. If you care about that, you got to go Pro, it seems. These new Pros, you've reported, also will have thinner bezels, potentially titanium frames, glass that curves and disappears more into the frame, and potentially a periscope camera lens for the Pro Max. Any more details you can shed around that, Mark?
I mean, the big thing is the bezels. It uses this new technology called LiPo, L-I-P-O, and that stands for some fancy long scientific name, but it's essentially a new production process for manufacturing displays that allows them to get the bezels. It's going to be about a third thinner than the bezels on the iPhone 14 Pro. And if you look at the bezels on the 14 Pro, it's not like they're thick bezels by any means, but now they're going to be getting, much closer to the edge. Yeah, you can see they're not that thick. But already thinking about, those new thinner bezels and looking at the bezels on my 14 Pro, now they suddenly, in my brain, they seem thick to me. But at the end of the day, it's a border around a phone, $1,000 phone display. So, who really cares in the long run.
Yeah.
I'm pretty excited for the new titanium frame. That makes the phone a bit lighter. It feels, you know, 5 to 10% lighter. So that's going to be quite significant, I think. But if you use a case, again, yes. does that really matter, right? So those are going to be two enhancements on the industrial design there. The A17 chip, better battery life. That's going to be quite significant. And then the periscope camera. Periscope camera is a fancy term for those unfamiliar, which allows you to get a wider range of optical zoom. That means it's using the actual hardware to zoom in rather than software. And as you know, anyone who uses digital zoom on an iPhone, you know the quality dips so significantly, right?
So bad.
Right? So you're going to get
basically
double the zoom going from 3x to 6x through hardware. So that's going to be a nice quality of life improvement.
I never thought I'd be a Zoom photography girl until I went into the woods the other day. I was looking for deer, and there were some deer far away. And I was like, I'm not going to go close enough to startle them. But the zoom lens on this iPhone 14 Pro that I'm using is obnoxiously bad.
Right.
It's so bad. So I was like, this is good news. Optical zoom would be much
especially
better.
When Android phones are getting a lot of crazy optical zoom options or doing wild things. Apple, it does feel like Apple has to compete here. So specifically, Mark, you reported that the periscope lens will likely just be for the Pro Max because it's bigger and it's going to have more room. My issue with the Pro Maxes is that they have been so heavy. It's like basically half a pound. Like I like to test them. Yep. I would not want to live with them. Since this is going to have a titanium frame, do you think it's going to be appreciably, you know, lighter than the previous models?
I think 5 to 10%. But like I said, if you use a case, it's really not going to make a difference. Have you ever tried the iPhone night mode, like in a really dark exterior, try to take pictures of the stars or the moon?
Yeah.
Have you tried that? Mm-hmm. It actually works pretty well. I'm not 100% sure if they're going to add a dedicated feature for it like Google has, but hopefully the zoom capabilities can play into that. I love taking pictures of the stars. And obviously this week we had the thing with the moon outside.
The moon.
Right? And so,
you
know, hopefully some enhanced feature there. Not that I know if that's coming or not. That would be nice. But definitely if you're listening to this, you haven't tried taking pictures outside of stars deep in the night with the night mode on the iPhone, you should give that a shot.
Mm-hmm. It probably looks a little less impressive than some of those Samsung moonshots, which I think they're still reporting going around. Like they're just kind of faking some of those. But yeah, that's hilarious. This may be the first time I'm considering an actual Pro Max just for that zoom. So I don't know. I guess we'll see.
I'm thinking about it too.
Definitely tempted. So Dynamic Island, as we talked about, is likely going to be going to the iPhone 15. I feel like since Apple announced it with the Pro models last year, like, we haven't really
they've
seen
done nothing.
Much from it.
It's exactly as I predicted. I called it the not-so-dynamic island when it launched. There's not really a ton of new functionality that it brought to the table. It's sort of a new interface. In a way, and I hate to say this, but it was basically the most Apple-like feature because they were putting lipstick on a pig, right? The ugliest portion of the iPhone is that notch. It's that cutout. And they took that and they've spun it into a feature. If that's not the most Apple marketing thing that you can think of, I don't know what is. And it works well. It's fluid. It's nice. But like I said, I feel like Apple comes out with these new software-based features on an annual basis, rolls them out, and then moves on and completely forgets about them and does nothing to enhance it. And the amount that they've added to the Dynamic Island since it first rolled out last year has been extraordinarily minimal. Now, is there a possibility Apple rolls out a slew of iPhone 15 hardware-specific Dynamic Island features in September? Entirely possible. But for now, the Dynamic Island is a nice to have, but I don't think it really changes the iPhone user experience. It's not necessarily a reason to upgrade.
Pretty.
It's nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's funny because I used to think that, wow, like, when I first saw it, I was like, okay, it makes a difference. The funny thing is I've been hanging out with people who have the 13 Pro and the 12 Pro and I have the 13 Pro. And I'm like, oh, that's the 13 Pro. I just got the Dynamic Island. No, it's a whole ass notch. And I'm like, I absolutely thought the notch was a Dynamic Island. That's how minimal the difference actually is, which is very embarrassing for me to admit because this is my job. And so I was telling my friend, oh, crap,
oh,
I totally misidentified your phone.
I do feel like by going to the base iPhone, like that gives developers more of a reason to push it. Like
certainly point.
Some of the stuff we've seen would, you know, seems like it'll go somewhere. I know your time is limited, Mark, so we're just going to barrel through.
Well,
I want
to say one more thing.
Yeah,
on the Dynamic Island, on the thinner bezels, these enhancements, they're all a means to an end, right? what Apple really wants to do is roll out a borderless, notchless, cutoutless iPhone. And it takes years, if not a decade, to get to that point. And they started in 2017 with the iPhone X, removing the home button, and they've gradually shrunk the borders and shrunk the bezels. And so you're seeing this metamorphosis play out publicly over the last 5 years, and it's going to continue over the next 5 years, to go to that original iPhone design to a screenless, borderless iPhone. So we're seeing it play out and moving the dynamic island to more models, moving the bezels to something that's thinner using new LiPo technology. You're slowly getting there year after year. And the iPhone 15 Pro is going to represent the closest take yet to what their platonic ideal is for how the next generation of iPhone should look.
It's a really interesting way to see it. Yeah.
Speaking of design too, like, I think given everything we've talked about, it does seem like very minimal changes overall, visually at least. Like, this is not a huge design leap year for Apple. When do we expect to see like the next one? The next one where the iPhone may look actually functionally different?
I think it's going to be a while. It's certainly not going to be next year. I'm not even sure it's going to be 2020. Five, it could be 2026 or 2027 for that big leap. I mean, the days of these real big overhauls,
right,
those have been gone for a number of years. I mean, the big overhaul was going from the iPhone 7 to the iPhone 10. I think the two biggest design leaps ever in the history of the iPhone were probably going from the 3GS to the 4, so 2010. And then going from the 5 to the 6, right? And since then, it's all been pretty moderate, with a couple exceptions. The 4 to the 5, the 7 to the 10,
It fits with the thing you were just talking about, which is like, it's giving me the idea that Apple wants this platonic ideal, but it's not going to do that overnight. It wants to kind of get people used to these small changes along the way. So it's like the frog cooking in the pot of water. Instead of throwing it in boiling hot water, it's slowly warming up the water, right? Like, it's
except that's a bad thing for the frog.
I know, but
you want it to be a good thing for the users, right?
The company kind of understands people are like so resistant to so much change at once that it's just slowly getting there. I don't know. Kind of the sense I got when you
this is also the company who's like, hey, we're just changing all our chips, deal with it. You know,
that's funny. Well, they move as fast as they technically could. Right. And so I think that this frog analogy you made in the water, it is a result of the time it takes for the technology to develop. So there's two things at play here. One, they need to wait for the technology to become available. That's one. Two, they have to wait for the technology to become available at the scale that they need it at, right? There are things that they could potentially do at the scale of sales for the Google Pixel phone. But in order to get those technologies into things at the scale of 100 million units, that's a totally different problem. And then the byproduct of that is they get to slowly introduce people to these features over time and, like you said, warm them up to it.
So the fire being such a slow fire is not for the sake of the frog, but for the sake of the chef.
I guess. We're just going to keep going on this analogy, Trillin. We are clocking for time, but I do want to say, like, Mark, do you have any thoughts about Apple's ideas around foldables? There have been rumors that potentially maybe a foldable iPad, maybe something like the iPad mini that you can fold, could be a thing coming. Do you think that's kind of what Apple's thinking versus foldable iPhones?
I don't think there's anything imminent on foldables from Apple, but I know they're looking at foldables across the board, whether that's phones, Macs, iPads. It's funny. I was thinking about it. The laptop is the original foldable, right? But they certainly are looking at how they can make that more of a fold. I think they're really stuck on the idea of how they think that the technology that Samsung is using is a beta being played out in public. And I think the crease in the middle of the display, the sound that these foldable phones make when they open and shut, sort of the it feels a little too, maybe a little too flexible. It feels a little too flimsy. I think they're waiting for something that is less flimsy. Remember, the problem, which is also a benefit for Apple, obviously, is the scale and the amount of units they need. Imagine having 100 million units of that full display technology out there versus a few hundred or a few million units, right? The amount of support problems, the amount of technology problems, the amount of crease issues that are going to come up, it's a totally different ballgame between Apple units and the current Fold units.
Okay. Well, you know what, Mark? We had some questions about the Vision Pro.
Let's take them.
I'm thinking we saw the Vision Pro. Did you get to try it on at Apple's campus, by the way?
I did not try the Vision Pro at Apple's campus, no.
Gotcha. We did a couple episodes on that. I did a demo of it. It is quite like amazing technology. As somebody who's been like obsessively covering Apple for so long, where do you think that thing tells us where Apple's headed? Because for me, it feels like, you know, a world where there are no screens, really, for them.
You know, for Apple, the Vision Pro could go either way. It could be a complete flop, or it could be the beginning of their future. It could be the ultimate nail in the coffin for the iPhone, Mac, and iPad all in one fell swoop. And so it's still too early to see how that's going to play out. I think the first year of the Vision Pro is going to be rough. I think you're going to see a strong amount of sales to the early adopter crowd, the Apple fanboy crowd, the people like us, people listening to this podcast crowd. Mm-hmm. And so they'll get their million units sold probably in the first 1 to 3 months. And then after that, I think you're going to see a pretty significant drop off until the second generation product comes out at that lower price. And then it's going to probably take to the third or fourth generation to take off, but the price is going to have to come down pretty dramatically. They're going to have to get iPhone pricing, high-end iPad pricing for this to make any dent. I think at sub $1,000, this is something that they would sell so many of. But at $3,500, it's just so completely out of reach. I really think that there's a price range of between $3,000 and $5,000 where the amount of people buying it, the market is not going to change, right? But once you go below $1,000 or at that $1,000 price point, it would skyrocket. Now, I don't know how long it's going to take for Apple to get there. I certainly don't think the new low-end one coming, let's see, we're in 2023, this will hit in 2025. I don't think they're going to hit the $1,000 price point with that. I would say that it would be probably sub $2,000, maybe $1,600 to $1,800. I think that moves the needle, but not to the degree that Apple needs it to for this to be the future of the company.
Gotcha. So it sounds like some change is happening, but whatever it is with the Vision Pro will be very slow. That's kind of where we all landed. But you know what? I can't wait to get more time with it. I hope you get to try it out soon, Mark.
Mark, are you going to be at the event? Does Apple invite you to events?
I will be covering the event.
You'll be covering. Okay, so I'm just not going to see you in person. That's fine.
I can imagine like Apple just has one person dedicated to all of Mark's movements.
We were talking about maybe they like escort you in and out. They're like right by your side.
Oh, okay. Man.
I'll be covering the event. It's I'm looking forward to covering it. Looking forward to getting my hands on the new model. And stay tuned. A lot more reporting to come over the next week and a half or so.
Awesome. So much. So thank you, Mark. And I just want to tell people, hey, subscribe to the Power On newsletter at Bloomberg. I love getting that thing and getting like your insights, super quickly. Where can people find you on the internet these days, Mark?
Yeah, no, please, Bloomberg.com/PowerOn to sign up to get Power On in your inbox. Obviously, you can also access it at the Bloomberg website. But to get news from me across the board quickly, Twitter.com/MarkGurman or X.com/MarkGurman. And I'll see you online.
See you online, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks, all.
All right. Thanks again to Mark for joining us. And it's not just Apple that has events.
Oh, my God. I know.
This next month and over the next few months, this is time. This is prime tech event time. What is coming up, Sherlyn?
So we said, oh, sorry, I came back and everything is full force. This week was a week of invites, or maybe like last week we got Microsoft's invite for the September 21st event, right? So we know that's coming up. Then we've got Amazon actually announced earlier this year, like July or something, that they were having an event September 20th at their Virginia headquarters. And that got I got my invite to that this week as well. So we got Apple September 12th. We got Amazon September 20th. We got Microsoft September 21st. And all of these, all big events too. They're all going to show devices. They're all going to show hardware. It's hardware fall season. And then this week, on Wednesday, Google announced its Made by Google event is going to be happening on October 4th. in probably New York, I'm assuming. So I got my invite for that. So I got invites to everything, which makes me feel very like happy. You know, I'm like, oh, they all want
You're
me
all lined
there,
up. Yeah, fill up your calendar. You know what's coming. Better than being surprised. Better than getting a note 5 days before an event, like fly to Seattle. Devendra,
I was trying to say I'm popular. Okay, you just totally missed the point.
I don't know. No, what's your Threads follower count now, Sherlyn? That's
not great.
That determines how popular you are.
It's about 1,200. No, okay. Nobody uses Threads anyway.
What happened to the hundreds of millions of people that were on Threads? I don't know. That seems to die pretty quickly.
They're not following me.
We've got a lot of events coming. Actually, in between all this, I know Intel is going to be dropping some stuff at one of their events at the end of this month. Samsung is coming up in October. There's HP, OnePlus. IFA stuff is happening.
Well, IFA is going on like now-ish, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about it. But yeah, it's like event season. And if like any regular year, we'd be in Berlin right now, probably some of us freaking out over like how to get to Apple right after this or something. Doesn't Meta or Oculus have some kind of thing coming up too?
The Oculus Connect event is, I believe, also at the end of September, and we'll definitely hear more about the Quest 3 there. So, you know, we're looking forward to it. I'm already planning some travel. I'm going to be back in New York for this Microsoft Surface event. I need to send you some pictures, Sherlyn, because I found this Airbnb, which is a Kingdom Hearts like super fans Airbnb. So there are Keyblades on the wall. There are little Funko Pops everywhere. It's amazing.
Yes. Okay, that's awesome. I was going to say that's not relevant to my interest, but cute pictures, yes.
Cute pictures, I appreciate them. Also, I don't know what's going on with Airbnbs in New York, but yeah, a lot of crazy things.
They wild.
Yeah. Yeah, they're wild. And actually, so you just mentioned IFA is going on right now. We've got some news on the site from that. Basically, stuff from the familiar companies like HP, Lenovo, Hue. We don't have anybody on the ground at IFA, which I feel is still a little unusual for us. That was always a fun event to go to, you know, pre-pandemic.
I think that the people that we would normally send are either like, you know, recovering from accidents or not really in the with the bandwidth to travel for the show. So I don't know if we're ever going back to IFA.
Oh, we're definitely going to go back to IFA. It's so big. There's a lot of stuff happening. Yeah.
I don't really know. I think it's like if we have, it would be nice, right? It's always good for team building to go to these events. And I love going to Berlin when the plumbing works. But IFA, like many other shows, is, you know, losing a bit of importance, right?
That's true.
We can get a lot of the coverage remotely. For example, there will still be hands-ons from us around a lot of these IFA product announcements later this week. So I would recommend y'all stick to us, go to Engadget.com, refresh today, tomorrow, whatever, because there's some interesting products I've seen in person coming that we can't talk about right now. I wish I could have talked about it, but it's really interesting. And we saw that in New York. We didn't have to go to Berlin to see it.
True, a lot of stuff is just kind of winding down. I feel like of all the Euro events, I still hope Mobile World Congress sticks around.
Yeah,
we enjoy going to Barcelona, and also it's a rare time to like get to see all these companies we don't normally talk about, and it's a different perspective of the tech world. I remember the first time I went to Mobile World Congress in like 2012. That was where I saw some early 5G demos. That was where the Windows 8 launch event was at a hotel outside of Barcelona, and that was just. It's a very formative experience to see companies take big risks with big events like that. So I don't know. I hope we don't lose some of that stuff.
Yeah, remember like Samsung used to do their announcements of the S series at Mobile World Congress too. So used to be a big deal, and now it's just not quite.
And then they moved to, I think it was at CES 1 year, and then right after, now they just own right after CES, right? Like they just took over that space. So
it's just like, why? Can I have a break, please?
Is there any of the news coming out of IFA that, that you know, it's particularly memorable right now, Sherlyn?
I don't think that the news has all been officially announced yet. I know stuff coming up maybe next week, right? Maybe next week we'll chat about
That's true.
So we'll see. I will say that when Google announced Made by Google event is, you know, live, right? Like, what are we expecting to see? Obviously, we're going to see the Pixel 8, probably. And that's like Google apparently also sometime this week, quote, maybe accidentally leaked its own Pixel 8 Pro.
On the day Apple announced that the iPhone event is happening on September 12th.
I forget where it was.
It was a page on the Google store, apparently.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say I love how salty Google can get sometimes. Like, here you go. Listen, we were just talking about Apple and working with Apple and what that is and how fraught that can be with Mark, right? But then, like, with Google, it's very different. They're very like acceptable. Like they accept what happens, right? They're like, leaks, fine. Well, sure, of course, because, and I think that that's the healthier approach, because like everyone that cares about this news already knows it's coming, right? Everyone else that's gonna not know your stuff doesn't give a shit enough to check, you mm-hmm. know, to wait for your event to like yeah. be surprised and wowed by your generational increase in your specs. Like, I know there's going to be a Pixel 8 coming, right? I know you're going to make camera improvements. I know you're going to make processor improvements. This sort of stuff doesn't need to be hidden or guarded as secretly or closely.
And leaks
surprise
are,
me with something else.
Leaks are free publicity, too. Like, there's less exactly. of a need for these companies to get angry for it. What I will say is that it's a little, I don't know, a little desperate to
when
be
they
leaking
leak
your own stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, hey guys, I think I joked about this once about somebody leaving a phone. Yeah, somebody left a Pixel phone at a bar. It was either a year or two ago. And I had joked, this was out there for a while and nobody cared because it was like a Pixel. It wasn't like big news. Now it seems right. like it's just funny that Google's just like, hey, let's do this thing. I feel like the leaks have to be a little more organic from the community side.
Yeah.
To really have yeah. that flavor to them, you know?
I get that. I understand that. I mean, like, yeah, I just don't understand the, like, you know, tightly guarding information to the point where, like, you know, you make your own employees feel so, you know, walking on eggshells around all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know.
For, but like, an iterative fine. Device upgrade.
Exactly.
Yeah, oh, my God, you're working on a Pixel 8?
A
Who imagined? Now, if it was like, oh, we have completely reimagined. We have a three-dimensional folding phone with a projection display. If it's, like, a secret product, then sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Go yeah, a little crazy.
Exactly. Or the Pixel Watch, right? I get that. Pixel Watch was highly anticipated last year.
Sure it was. Yeah. Yeah.
You so mean. Okay.
So mean. Oh, man. Okay, let's move on to some other news. And there's a bunch of things yeah. happening this week. And I think the biggest one is that Meta announced that it took down thousands of fake accounts linked to a massive propaganda campaign from the Chinese government. Carissa Bell wrote this up for us. And I think it's notable because it's just so big. You know, Meta and social networks typically talk about like, oh, yeah, we found these like weird these weird propaganda accounts and we stamped them out. Meta says that they took down 7,700 Facebook accounts, 954 pages, 15 groups, and 15 Instagram accounts, which makes it one of the largest networks of fake accounts that they've ever uncovered.
Yeah, I think it's funny. So according to Meta, the fake accounts that were, you know, on all these platforms were trying to spread pro-China messages, including, quote, positive commentary about China and its province Xinjiang and criticisms of the United States, Western foreign policies, and critics of the Chinese government using, including journalists and researchers. I'm just like, I guess, look, I guess I think
do.
I would see through it.
Sure.
And yes, it's what they do. They've been doing this for years through like other types of media, except for like, I guess social media is a little more insidious. But like, A, who's friending all these people? Who's following all these people on YouTube, TikTok, Pinterest?
It's not about
friending
it. It's more they get the content out there. You know how this works, Sherlyn. And then people share it. Your grandma, your aunt shares it
here's
to the family messenger group.
It
just goes over. Well,
I was coming to that point, which is that like, I think I would see through it, but I realize that there's a lot of misinformation out there. And the fact that people buy all of that misinformation tells me how susceptible people must be about shit like this. So I get it. It's going to be...
Totally get it, yeah.
It's good they took it down, right? Like, I have never met anyone that was convinced by any of this fake shit in my life, but... You know, there are people out there that probably are.
I don't think you talk to. Yeah, you're not talking enough to your older family members, like the crazy uncles.
I feel called out.
Yeah. It's like you talk to them. They're like, I've been sending you this stuff on Facebook. Did you know what they're doing?
Well, my family.
Kids? Yeah.
Yeah, my aunts and uncles themselves are the ones spreading their rhetoric. So
exactly. I mean, it's a whole thing. And also, I'm not too surprised we're seeing this, too, because, hey, I don't think we ever fully reckoned with like Russia's propaganda campaign leading up to 2016, which by many, many accounts directly helped the former president. So this is a big deal. And I think it's important that these companies are paying attention to this. They're calling.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Meta caught it and noticed and did something about it, right? Yeah,
totally great. And yeah, stay tuned to Carissa Bell's reporting on all this stuff, because she immediately jumps on any major social media news. She's always there.
Yeah, she's great.
She's always there. So yes, please read Carissa. We also covered the Fairphone 5, which Daniel Cooper calls boring yet exciting.
Which is surprising because Dan loves the Fairphone and the Fairphone brand.
No, that's so perfect. That is the perfect description.
I know.
It's a great phone. It looks like this is a great phone. And Fairphone's whole idea, right, is that it's modular, it's repairable. It's more sustainable from parts, from the people getting, you know, building these things. Boring isn't always a bad thing because it shouldn't be like, oh my God, I can't believe they did this.
I guess I read that like a sarcastic, right? Because the headline we got in here is the Fairphone is boring. How exciting.
And how exciting.
Yeah. And I read how exciting instead of how exciting. Like, oh my God.
Wow. I feel like we have to have a sit down on the chair here and wrap into like just why
I need another break. Really.
Yeah, reading all the negativity here. But no, Daniel Cooper loves the Fairphone. And I think we all like the Fairphone phones. And this company has been pushing, you know, this idea for almost a decade now. And according to Dan, it sounds like this one is like, it's great. It is fully great, and not even, it doesn't seem like that unique compared to looking at other mid-range Android phones. It has a 6.46 inch LG OLED display, a 4200 milliamp battery. Doesn't have a headphone jack anymore. They killed that last time, so that sucks. But a lot of these parts are, you know, separated components. The display itself costs around $108. To replace, which is far cheaper than replacing your iPhone screen or a Samsung screen. It's using Qualcomm's octa-core it's an octa-core SoC, which hasn't been used in many other phones but doesn't need to be super powerful. Like, it just has everything you need. This seems great. I mean, listen, Sherlyn, like, you are doing the mobile thing, you're leading our mobile coverage. Do you think this phone has a chance or anything like this?
I think it has a very niche appeal. I think if you think about the mass market or the average smartphone shopper, they only know to choose between iPhone and Samsung, really. Maybe if they're a little more tech woke, they're like Google. But the Fairphone needs a lot of A, word of mouth, B, marketing to get out there. And that's what it is, right? Like, people may not be able to also contend with the idea of modularity in a phone. I don't think they understand what it means. I think they've just gotten so used to having every, but I could see if you pitch it like, oh, it's like, you know, smartphones from our past, or phones from our past, right? Where you can replace a battery like that. You know, like, we could remember when we have phones where you could snap out the battery.
That's not that easy. Joy. You still have to like unscrew a bunch of things.
I know, but like, if you pitch it kind of like that, you know, yeah. I know they had to carry a screwdriver around, which would defeat the purpose, but.
I don't know if it'll ever be mainstream, but certainly for the tinkers or the tinkers at heart. Yeah. Like, this thing, there's no U.S. release date yet, but you can pre-order it for €699, around $750, which is fine, but I also think is a little more than, more than a mid-range phone these days, because you could get a good Android phone. Like, what are the Pixel A's going for at this point? Like, $300 to $400?
Yeah, about $400, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I feel like $750...
That's a great phone.
That's a great phone. $750 is close to, like, what you'd pay for the base iPhone, you know? So this is kind of, like, a tough spot for them, but I'm sure some people would be into this. Fairphone has pledged for software updates for a long, long while. And also, like, they've been around long enough where you can assume, like, there will be replacement parts if you need it. They're not just going to disappear. The whole idea of modular hardware, it needs support, right? Like, when Dell announced that they were doing that Alienware Area 51 desktop hardware and a laptop thing, they gave up on that in 2 years. So you got nothing to replace, really.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's why you need mass market appeal, really, for anything to have any longevity. And it's kind of, that's where I'm skeptical about this, right? I love the idea, not sure it has legs, not sure it has like long-term legs.
I do feel like, I don't know how long Fairphone can keep doing this on their own. They're a Dutch, independent Dutch company. I'm sure somebody is being like Asus or somebody is like, yeah, we can help make you bigger. Come
join us. Didn't Asus have not a modular phone, but like a phone, the phone pad. Remember the phone pad?
I remember the phone pad, but I think somebody would want to snap up Fairphone. Honestly, keep it Euro. Like, who has Nokia now? Where is that license?
HMD.
Oh, yeah.
HMD.
Okay. Yeah. So that's China, right? Yeah. So, Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything.
They are all owned by China now, Devendra. We can have whole episode where we talk about the state of the smartphone market, both internationally and domestically, because the Fairphone could never get in the U.S. because, first of all, they need to suck all of the carriers.
The Fairphone 4 did get released here. It just took a long time. So I think the...
Which carrier?
I don't know. I think you could just buy it. I have to look it up, but we did cover that.
Okay.
But the Fairphone 5 will take a while. It'll take a while before it actually gets to us. It's just a thing. But hey, I'm glad that they are surviving. I also want to mention that JBL, announced that it's ready to take on Sonos. Finally, after almost 20 years of Sonos being in business. But JBL announced the Authentics multi-room home speakers. And what's really cool about these is that they look like those classic JBL speakers from the 70s, the L100s. They had this like grid boxy aesthetic. So if you look at like speaker forums or like, you know, people selling stuff on eBay, those things still cost a lot because as we've talked about, speakers can last forever if you take care of them. And speaker wire is a basic standard that's been around forever, like since speakers have been around. So you can still play decades old speakers just fine. These things look pretty cool. The highest end version, which is pretty expensive, the Authentics 500, it has Dolby virtualized audio, Dolby Atmos audio for $700. So that is actually a lot more than Sonos's most expensive standalone speaker. I have to look up the exact price, but it was typically like around $500 for the Play 5 and stuff. They have a Authentics 300 model for $430 with 360-degree audio and a smaller Authentics 200 that they say can get stereo sound for $330. So that's the one going against the Sonos One. The Sonos One is like the, you know, or the Era 100. That's their newest one. But that's their entry-level one that is affordable and can deliver big sound for not much money. So kind of cool. I think for a long time, if you weren't aware of JBL's like classic speakers, you know, they made a lot of car stereos, a lot of car audio, boomboxes for a while. I don't think JBL as a brand really ever, I think they had lost a lot of cachet even among like hi-fi aficionados. So this is a cool thing to see.
It's so weird, yeah.
Yeah, I hope they keep it up. One thing that they say is that they are the first smart speakers that can do two voice assistants at once. So they have both Alexa and Google Home support. Like you can just talk to both immediately.
Either one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Typically, like supporting both isn't actually rare. You could do that, I think, on the Sonos's, but you have to choose. You can only do Google or you can only do Alexa. So,
which makes sense, right? Like, who's going to ask both of them the same at once? You know what I mean? Like,
you know, listen, as I have filled my home with smart home devices, there are some things you can ask Google. There are some things you can ask Amazon.
True. I have both at home. Yeah.
Yeah. And like different smart devices connected different, like have different hooks to things. So not everything that can talk to Alexa can talk to Google. So it's annoying. It is super annoying. I'm not a fan. But this is one way to make it easier. I also want to point out Tom Warren over at The Verge wrote this story about malware-like pop-ups showing up in Windows 11 to get people to ditch Google. He said while looking up something in Chrome, he was switching back to a game, a pop-up appeared and told him, hey, you should probably switch your default search engine to Microsoft Bing.
Search engine or search browser?
Engine. Search engine. Uh-oh. Switch the default search engine to Microsoft Bing in Chrome. And this is a pop-up that kind of stopped everything he was doing and kind of appeared on top of Windows. And this executable seems weird. It didn't show up in his notifications tray. It just seemed like a weird thing. I just want to say, I don't know if you've noticed this, Sherlyn, but I do think Microsoft is getting a little too aggressive about this stuff. Like when with everything, like when I start new computers, whenever I'm reviewing a computer, I like to get Chrome along with Edge on that computer. If I'm searching for Chrome, a big pop-up appears when I'm using Microsoft Edge. A pop-up appears. You've already got a great browser. You don't need to go download Chrome. And this happens throughout too. There are some, other folks pointed out, like, if you are in Chrome search results, Microsoft can take over Chrome search results in Bing, according to a screenshot from Sean Hollister at The Verge, which is just really weird, too, because it's like you're doing a Chrome search and then it does like it just like took it. It took that result and gave it to you in Bing with the Bing AI stuff on top.
Oh, yeah.
This is it's just skeevy. Like, to me, this feels really weird, especially for Microsoft right now, which is trying to pretend it's playing well with everybody. And also, especially for Microsoft, which got in a lot of trouble for
I'm like, this is reminiscent of what they used to do, no?
This is reminiscent of the whole 90s things where people and the U.S. government basically said that they were, you know, pushing a monopoly by including Internet Explorer on Windows and kind of devaluing other browsers. It was a whole thing. Not really much amounted from that. Like, it took... It wasn't until like 2010, 2011, like almost a decade after that ruling, when I started writing about tech, I was able to write about the repercussions for Microsoft's bad behavior in the 90s. And a lot of it was just a pop-up in Europe to be like, hey, don't worry, you can actually use multiple browsers, long after everybody had settled on like Firefox or Chrome or something. So
yep.
The punishment for Microsoft, you know, that I think they paid a pretty hefty fine, but in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter, because what Microsoft wants is market share. So they will pay the fines and accept punishment if it means it's still a market share win for them, you know? So really weird, really skeevy. Microsoft hasn't fully responded. I think a representative said they're aware of these reports and have paused that specific notification while they investigate. But it's part of like a...
I mean, what a... Yeah. What are they investigating? Like, is there some rogue engineer inserted code and was like, here, let's start doing this?
No, I think it was a thing they had planned to do, but maybe the trigger for it. Like, I think Tom Warren was like, I don't know why this happened. And this is a weird executable that I've never seen on my system before. So I think people who know Windows, like, whenever I see something weird, I go straight to the task manager. I look at what's running see, like, what's happening. Yeah. If I see a weird executable there, I get a little worried. Tom noticed that it was digitally signed by Microsoft, so it wasn't malware, but still... You buy this computer, right? You pay for a Windows license. Even if you're buying a computer that has Windows pre-installed, the Windows license is a part of that price. It just seems really crummy that Microsoft spends so much energy being like, well, you can't use it the way you want. You have to use it our way. Just not.
I mean, I'm not sure they're quite saying that with this like little pop-up thing.
No, but they totally are. Like it's constant.
I'm forcing you to change.
It's constant, though. It's like, it's very annoying. It's very
clippy-like. They're trying to wear you down.
Yeah, they're wearing you down until, like, you just flip that default, just so they stop bothering you. It's like stochastic terrorism over here for search engines. They're just wearing you down, man. I'm not a fan. But you know what? Folks, if you have noticed this in your Windows travels, drop us an email at podcastandgadget.com. Let us know how you feel about this, because it irks me. It annoys me quite a bit, even though I like Microsoft typically. I rag on them far less than like other companies, but they still do really dumb things, you know, and it's really annoying.
I love that we have our favorites. One of your favorites is Microsoft. One of my favorites is Google.
I mean, listen, it's natural to have faves. You're still a Windows user. You know, you're not a Chrome OS user main time, like full time, Sherlyn. We all have our faves, and I think Microsoft post Nadella and a lot of the things he's done for the company have been for the better. You know, so it is a far better company than it used to be. But man, is it still? Sometimes they still do big company things. Another bit of news I want to mention, which we forgot to mention last week, and I'm kicking myself about this now too. India managed to land its moon lander. Let me see here. The Chandrayaan 3 spacecraft's Vikram lander landed on the south pole of the moon last Wednesday. And since then, it has been taking pictures. It actually took a picture of the lander too, of like a little selfie, not quite a selfie. It took a picture of its like sibling that it was hiding him.
Aww.
And it's moving. It's taking photos. According to India, like space folks, like they're saying, like they're watching out for craters on the moon, and they've been able to avoid some big ones, because if it falls in there, it's bad news. It's also the first spacecraft to land at the moon's south pole, which can be really useful for testing the surface and testing, you know, helping to figure out like how much water ice is actually on the moon. I think they also did some testing on the surface immediately and detected like, hey, there is indeed a lot of sulfur here and a lot of other minerals here, which we could tell remotely, but we didn't have the full information there. So
Right.
Yeah.
You didn't actually get the material directly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this makes India the fourth country to achieve a soft landing on the moon. The first, like I said, to land on the lunar South Pole. Actually, just before this, one of Russia's moon landers also crashed in its attempt like a couple days before. So the moon space race is on. We've talked about what the U.S. is doing as well. I believe it is the Artemis lander that we're expecting to go in the next couple years. Artemis 3 mission in late 2025. That's the mission to return people to the moon with NASA. So that's kind of cool. The United Arab Emirates also wants to land by 2024. It's cool to see countries kind of devoting resources to this and not just having it all taken up by SpaceX, basically, even though they will probably still rely on SpaceX and other private companies to get rockets and things like that. So it's happening. True. It's cool. I think it's pretty cool news. Let's move on to what we're working on. What are you working on, Sherlyn, these days?
I mean, this week has been a blur since coming back. I've been catching up, you know, doing some pre-event planning stuff. And, you know, we've got some coworkers out this week, so covering on the edit side of things and helping other coworkers. I'm also in the, you know, working on some behind the scenes stuff for this report that I've been working on forever, but I never really found the time to put, you know, any actual work in. Can't talk about that yet. And then also internally getting up some, like, I don't know, training materials for some other people on the team. So, you know, fun stuff. I'm disappearing into the black background slowly.
Disappearing into the bushes. I mean, I'll give some folks some behind the scenes news. Like, we are also like reworking our job descriptions in Engadget. So, like, the things we're doing are changing a bit. I'm going to be leaning a little more into the podcast and maybe a little away from some like laptop stuff. So things are changing. We'll still be doing great coverage. Expect the type of coverage to change up quite a bit.
Yeah, but also more focus on what matters to some of us more, right? Like, to make those things better, we kind of need to devote a bit more time and attention. So I think it'll be for the best. It's just a transitional period right now. We're all kind of like figuring it all out.
For sure. We do want to grow this podcast. So if you're enjoying, please tell your friends. We were just bouncing some ideas around, like maybe another episode during the week, maybe a cool interview series or something. So we've got ideas, folks. Shout podcastingagadget.com if there's specifically things you'd love to see. I'd love to do some like, I don't know what it would be, but I'd love to do some highly produced, you know, Radio Lab-esque episodes or dives
I like that idea. I've been trying to get us to do that for any like big report.
I see producer Ben's eyes light up and he's doing high fives and dancing around the room right now. So, you know, it's a thing. It's a thing we've talked about and we would all love to do. If there are any specific stories you want us to dive into, let me know.
Like how, like the behind the story, right? Like how did we get this story? I mean, we don't have a lot of stories that are like worth that much of a deep dive, but you know, the Dyson Zone testing, I would love to get Malak on to talk about her experience testing it or that sort of thing. But we'll anyway, see. What are you actually working
on?
What am I working on?
Right? I'm working on reassessing like how I'm working for one thing. But I'm still testing LG's Ultra Gear 49-inch gaming monitor. I've talked about this before. Now I've had more time with it, and I gotta say, like, man, things have changed a lot in the past 5 years since I first have seen 49-inch monitors. It was back in like, actually over 5 years, right? It was 2017 that Samsung showed off one of its first ones. And it was just like, it was a private event, a private thing to go to in New York City. We couldn't bring it into the office. It was big. It was unwieldy. It was also, the resolution was too short because typically with ultra-wides, it's like something by 1440 or by 1080p. And this one was 1080p as the vertical pixels. And that was just way too short for me because I use a lot of ultra wides. I'm used to like 3440 by 1440. So that's like having two 1440p monitors side by side, basically. So this one I'm using has a much larger resolution. It is still very, very wide and you just can't get over that fact. But it's really good. It's really fast. It's super fast for games. It has one of the fastest refresh rates I've seen. I'm playing, I'm playing G-Sync games, G-Sync supported games on this powered by the NVIDIA RTX 4090. So I've got like a lot of horsepower. I just like crank this thing up for Cyberpunk and for Halo Infinite. And what is that? There's a new shooter that's like an old school shooter right now. I'm playing a bit of that. Trying to think of what else. Also Armored Core 6, which Ben and I were talking about. I have done some Armored Core 6, and let me tell you, having a super, super wide screen in front of you is almost like being in VR. It's like being in one of those weird arcade setups where you cannot see the outside world, and it's just you and the game, and that's kind of cool. So yeah, I'm a fan. I'm in the process of writing this up right now. I don't think it's for everybody because it is a little unwieldy. Like my process for, I have to get a webcam fitting. So I have to like push it all the way down. I have to like hook my microphone over the top with the arm to get it to fit properly. So depending on your workflow and the size of your desk, it may not be ideal. I also know some people like to use monitor arms and this thing is, it's kind of heavy. So I don't know how many monitor arms would actually support it. I think the sweet spot for me, and the thing I think a lot of people need to take a closer look at, are the like 34-inch ultra-wide monitors, because they are just glorious. They can fit on most desks. They get you like great, basically the screen space of dual monitors, and they're still super immersive for games and stuff. So when I reviewed the Alienware 34-inch OLED, QD OLED screen last year, I believe, I still like think about that and how cool that display is. And whenever I get rid of, like, whenever I have to send back this 49-inch LG, I'm probably going to go for another 43-inch or maybe a sweet spot in between. Maybe like a 40-inch or a 42-inch. There are more sizes popping up, but it's kind of cool to see that, hey, these things are useful. They have all the gaming features you want. They're still expensive, but screens are expensive. And if it's important to you, like, I think it's worth paying that cost. So yeah, this LG Ultra Gear is pretty cool. Let's move on to our picks for the week. What do you got, Sherlyn?
I think mine's kind of a depressing pick, actually. There have been a lot of documentaries released lately. Mine, this week's pick, is a fair, like, not as new. The documentary I watched recently on Netflix is Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story.
Okay.
Jimmy Savile, I think you've heard, I don't know if you guys have heard of him, you have, you're nodding, is this prolific pedophile. And was just incredibly famous in the UK since the beginning of TVs, right? Like, it's just, it was wild to me because I had never heard of this person up until this past weekend. And, like, everyone British that I know that I talked to is like, oh, yeah, Jimmy Savile. I'm like, oh, shit, what the hell? I never knew this. And I was talking to my friend Michelle from the gym, and she was telling me that she had seen it too. And she was like, yeah, both me and her have no idea who Jimmy Savile was, but both of us were like, our British friends all are like, this guy's
it didn't really translate much to the US, but it is a thing like I vaguely have heard about. Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, so the documentary itself, I mean, I have some little issues because I do my job, like, because of the job I have issues with the way it tells the story. I have issues with the choice of footage sometimes, but it's kind of a horrifying story about how much this person was able to get away with. And he wasn't even like discovered until he passed, like until after his death. And so like, what are you going to do to a person? You couldn't have stopped him. And then also there were some like really harrowing victim stories. And it's just really, really terrible to like see, but hey, if you were looking for a harrowing documentary to watch this week, you can check out Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story on Netflix. Another thing that's really interesting to note is that I think they're working on a sort of television series about this guy, and it's going to star Steve Coogan.
You
know Steve Coogan, right?
I know Steve Coogan. So, okay, I could see that. I could see that fitting. Okay. Kind of cool. Well,
dark, bleak.
Dark, bleak. Hopefully next time, Sherlyn was going to give us something happy, happy. But I also actually have a sort of not quite dark, but kind of a bleak documentary. It's Telemarketers on HBO, which is a cool, first of all, thank God, is it three parts. It's just 1, 2, 3 episodes, not like an overlong streaming series, which they tend to do. And this is about two guys who were members or who worked at a telemarketing company, I think in the 2000s or 2010s, called CDG. And they did this thing where they would like call up people and just straight up lie about raising money for police unions or, you know, police, say, get the police weapons or something, or fallen officers funds. And they would raise a lot of money, typically from older folks who were maybe little, who didn't quite understand like what was happening. But they would raise this money and keep most of it. And maybe 10% went back to the police. And It's a weird marketing scheme, and these guys basically, since they were working there, it was Sam Lipman Stern who co-created the documentary, and Pat Pespis, who's this great character, like an older guy who was just like really gregarious. Everybody loved him, and he was like the life of the party there. But they were both so incensed by what this company was doing, they were like, okay, we need to try to take them down. And the show is about them going through that process of trying to take them down. I'm not going to spoil too much here, but let me just say, the power of America and the power of rich people to avoid any consequences is really the ultimate takeaway here. And feels kind of familiar as we're watching these stories about, you know, former presidents and the people around them and how they seem to be able to do whatever they want. It's kind of untouchable. It's frustrating, but it is ultimately, it feels like bleakly realistic in that way. I think it is worth watching, though, because there are probably people in your family who have gotten these calls. There are probably people in your family. Typically, when you get this, when you give money to these companies, you get a sticker. You get like a police sticker and you put it on the back of your car and you're like, I support the cops. I support this police union. And when I was growing up, a lot of people in my family did this because they would get these calls and, you know, they're like, okay, this sounds reasonable. I want to support the cops. And there was also this like running myth that if you have this sticker on the back of your car, you would be pulled over less. You would get less tickets because the cops would be like, hey, they like us. I'll take care of this guy. That's kind of BS. That's never actually the way it worked, but it was like a myth propagated by these companies. And yeah, I do remember telling family members like, this is, you're just giving money to crooks to get a sticker. You're getting a sticker that has no power, but you think it has power. It's a whole thing. It's very sad and depressing because these companies, the people behind these companies made hundreds of millions of dollars. Like they made bank while employing people for very little money and also basically scamming money from older folks and more vulnerable folks in America. And there's very little that the government can do to stop it. Like there was some pushback, but these companies, they're like, you know, it's like a hydra, like you cut off one head and it just grows back up somewhere else. It's to me, I find that thing just kind of depressing because that's life, man. You want the story of like, hey, you have this big scoop and this big revelation and you change the world and bad things stop happening. But the message of the series is basically no. Good effort. But they are rich. You see, and the rules don't apply to them. So, yeah.
My friends are hooked on this show and they've been talking about it. So I think even
you should watch it.
It's just like watching any kind of drama. Yeah, it's next on my list. I'm going to go watch it. But I also wanted to, I know you have another pick, but also quickly to interject, I do have something upbeat that I started watching that I think Jess Condit has actually recommended on this show before. I started watching Ultimatum, the Ultimatum queer season, the all queer season. Mm-hmm. And it's freaking amazing. It's fantastic. It's like, oh, so cool. So yeah, that's a good watch if you're into that sort of show, dating reality TV.
Something a little brighter, I guess. Yeah.
A little lighter, I guess.
A little lighter. I've also seen the Gran Turismo movie, which I think nobody was really excited about. And I wrote this up at Engadget too. And I think my main takeaway is like, man, this is actually a pretty good sports movie in terms of like the formula of a sports movie. You have a down and out newcomer who has a pure heart and really wants to be good and become the top of his field or something and get into professional sports. In this case, it follows the story of Jan Martinborough, who is this is a real story. This is a real life person. He was a Gran Turismo fanatic who played the game endlessly. He was invited to participate in a contest co-sponsored by Sony and Nissan in the early 2010s. He placed very well in that digital contest, and the whole idea is to get the gamers into real cars so they can race in the real world. And you know, not huge spoilers for real life because you've probably heard his name out there in the news, but Jan Martinborough did become a pro racer, is still racing, did the stunts for the races in this movie actually too, for the actor playing him. So it's like this, it's this really cool gamer story. Gamers, like, this is the gamer's dream. You want to be good at something in the real world as you are in the virtual world. But I just couldn't help like, man, think like how much this is a marketing like machine by Sony too. This is probably before your time, Sherlyn. I hate every time I have to say that. But there was this movie called The Wizard. I think it was in like 1989.
Of Oz?
Yeah. 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 But The Wizard was about Fred Savage and his friends going to a major video game tournament where they played Super Mario Brothers 3. And in that was the first time anybody in America had seen Super Mario Brothers 3. So it was like this big just it was a movie in theaters, but really it was like this big marketing event for Nintendo too, because it led to a ton of sales for Super Mario Brothers 3. This movie begins with like an almost like pre-produced like commercial from Sony talking about the creator of Gran Turismo. He spent 10 years developing a game that was so realistic. Before we are even introduced to characters or anything, we get this promo. Hey, Gran Turismo is really important. Don't forget that. Throughout the movie, they never call it a game. It's actually offensive to call it a game. It is a simulation. It is a driving simulation.
So
okay?
Like flight simulator, basically.
Yeah, yeah. This is a movie where one character, I do think a lot of the actors are great. David Harbour is great. David Harbour from Stranger Things is in this.
Yes.
He has a cassette Walkman player.
Of course
and
he does.
This movie is set in like the early 2010s. You know, and people make fun of him for it. He's like, no, man, I love it. I love this thing. And at one point, slight spoilers, he gets a digital Walkman. A Walkman that plays digital files. And it's like, it's so important for him. He is so like, I can't believe it. This is a world where iPhones don't exist. This is a world where like iPods or other devices don't exist. This is a Sony world where only Sony devices can solve problems. So that's kind of funny. I've literally never seen the Walkman digital audio player out in the real world. Like outside of stores, the only time...
I never saw it either.
Occasionally Hideo Kojima, you know, the creator of Metal Gear Solid, will tweet about, I'm listening to this. And he's a big, you know, big supporter of Japanese tech. So like he's like, he has a Walkman and he takes pictures of his Walkman. But I don't think that device exists anywhere else. So anyway, listeners, if you like those things, let me know. But yeah, this feels like such a weird Sony marketing attempt. And that really hurts the fact that it's a pretty decent sports film, because I think the racing feels good. It's shot really creatively. It's directed by Neil Blomkamp of District 9 fame. And that's a guy who has never really found success again since that first movie. But I think this is, you know, his best movie since District 9. The script is crap, but the actors really, really push it. So I love the actor who plays the young Jan, Archie Madekwe. David Harbour is great. Orlando Bloom's in this movie and he's not very good, but he's in.
I love Orlando Bloom.
He's not very
good.
He's not very good.
Okay.
But fun movie. Maybe not worth seeing in the theaters, but if you can get to see this movie at a matinee price, I think it's worth it, because it is good to watch it on a big screen and have a big sound system and just really feel it, because I think Neil Blomkamp does a good job with that. So yeah, Gran Turismo, not bad, but man, is it cringe.
Well, that's it for this week's episode, everyone. Thank you as always for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra at mastodon.social, Blue Sky at Devendra. I'm still on Twitter, but I'm not like, I'm just like retweeting progressive stuff and stuff that where I want to lift people's platforms. I'm not promoting anything on Twitter anymore.
If you want to send me your hot Apple tips so that I can be the next Mark Gurman, I am at Sherlyn Instagram on Threads. I am still at Sherlyn Low on Twitter or X, but I'm not looking at it a lot really. And you can always email me, Sherlyn, or Sher, C-H-E-R, at Engadget.com. Email us your thoughts at podcast@Engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes so people can discover us. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Staged.